From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moscowain. They were thrust into the war in Iraq, poorly trained and not quite ready for combat. One was a plumber, one a guitarist, another a postal worker, and yet another a DEA agent. Their mission was to advise and mentor the Snake Eaters, an Iraqi battalion tasked with fighting the insurgency in a town along the Euphrates River. When a former Marine major joined their ranks in 2006, he saw firsthand how treacherous the advisor role could be. The ragtag band of reservists, Marines, and National Guardsmen daily risked their lives alongside their Iraqi counterparts in a place where it was hard to distinguish the bad guys from the good guys, a place where dodging roadside bombs and car bombs and snipers was all in a day's work. Owen West is that former Marine, and when he's not fighting or writing, he is a managing director at Goldman Sachs. His new book, The Snake Eaters, An Unlikely Band of Brothers and the Battle for the Soul of Iraq, chronicles their story. It takes us straight to the battlefield with the men who faced an all but impossible assignment and reveals their courage, grit, and ingenuity in the face of overwhelming circumstances. Owen West is a graduate of Harvard and Stanford, a third-generation Marine with two combat tours in Iraq on his resume and two prior novels to his credit. He is also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and serves as director of the Marine Corps Scholarship Foundation. Of course, that's when he's not running 100-mile marathons or climbing Mount Everest. And Owen West joins us from the NPR Bureau in New York City. Owen, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, your book is fascinating, and I want to start by just asking, what's the significance of the name the Snake Eaters?
Well, all Marine units have nicknames. Indeed, most Marine infantrymen, you know, have nicknames for themselves. The Iraqi battalion that's the subject of the book was originally called 331, which is the typical boring numerical designator that we give infantry units. But after hanging around the Marines for a year, Marine advisors and Marine partner units, they decided they wanted a nickname. So they took the patch that they wore on their shoulder, which depicted a hawk grabbing a long-fanged snake, and they called themselves the Snake Eaters.
You open the book with a harrowing account of a convoy that is headed into Caladia that really shows us right from the beginning what these advisors were up against. Share, if you would, a brief version of that story with us.
Well, this is in many ways a classic underdog story. No one wanted the advisor mission to begin with. The United States military has employed advisors for over a century, sometimes very effectively. But in Vietnam, advisors began to become, and they became a symbol of mission creep and failure. So our entire advisory infrastructure, all the training, all the doctrine, was dismantled after that war. That cost us in Iraq. When the book opens, you've got a team of reservists, because no regular units wanted the advisor mission, who believed that they were going to go to Iraq to be on a secure base and maybe take some cell phone videos of Iraqis doing jumping jacks or marching around and post them on YouTube. And instead were put on an isolated outpost in the middle of Anbar province, which was the heart of the Sunni rebellion. And on day two, they were told that they weren't going to be training, they were going to be fighting, and they were thrust into combat. So on their very first patrol into Caladia, a strange city, they're still trying to figure out who the locals were, because, of course, in these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, no enemy has ever worn a uniform. The guerrillas tangle themselves within the population. We call this an insurgency. The advisors didn't even know they were supposed to be acting as counterinsurgents. They just wanted to stay alive, and they were hit by an explosive right from the get-go, which damaged their credibility with the Iraqis greatly.
I just can't imagine that experience for these guys who are coming in there with, as you pointed out, very little training. Why was it, Owen, that they were so poorly prepared for this?
Well, no one wanted the advisor mission, as I said. Our generals are very uncomfortable with this mission. Our generals are brought up to lead large numbers of U.S. troops. So you can imagine how foreign it is to them to break up their units and essentially hand over small 12-man teams to Iraqi colonels. The teams live independently. This team in the Snake Eaters had 10 men, and they lived among 500 Iraqis on an isolated outpost. When you read stories, as was in today's New York Times, about advisor teams being shot or murdered by their proteges, this is because they're very, very isolated and very exposed. Because no one wanted this advisor mission, the Pentagon handed it to reserves. Indeed, the two reserve units tasked with the original advisor mission in 2005 in Iraq had not deployed to combat since World War II.
Wow. And why was the training that they got, so flimsy, for lack of another word? You know, the fact that they went into this not even realizing that they could find themselves in combat, and then, you know, what do you do when the roadside bomb blows up and that sort of thing? Why were they not prepared well, you know, even though they were reservists, for what they were going to face over there?
That's a great question. Yeah, as reservists, they should have been trained arguably more properly than regular troops before thrusting them into combat, especially coming from units that had never or had not deployed in over 50 years. Reservists, by and large, are ad hoc groups, and the advisors were especially ad hoc. In this group of advisors, there was a rock and roll guitarist, and we have to remember that reservists have regular jobs. I mean, they only serve one weekend a month and 2 weeks a year, typically. There was a flooring specialist. They were led by a DEA officer, thank God, who had basically honed his counterinsurgency skills on the streets of Richmond, Virginia, during the drug wars. So in many ways, his name was Mike Troster. Mike Troster was very prepared to fight this, but the training was so misguided that he actually felt they went backwards in the short 45-day span that they spent essentially learning how to protect their own big base, number one, and number two, train via PowerPoint slides and blackboard chalkboard presentations instead of the reality of the fact that an advisor's first job is to fight.
Right. Is that why some of them ended up sort of going off script, so to speak, and began to really make up their own rules based on what situation they found themselves in?
Well, you know, there was no script. And indeed, today in Afghanistan, there is still no script. I mean, it's astonishing to learn that after 10 years of fighting both these counterinsurgencies, where your basic task is to strip the insurgents of their anonymity, so you're tangled up in a very complex war among peoples, that we still don't have a basic doctrine for advisors, which was discarded, as I said, after Vietnam because the mission became so unpalatable.
Yeah.
So they made it up as they went along, and the first thing they realized was that in order to have any kind of operational sway or influence over the Iraqis, they needed to have credibility. And the easiest way to build credibility was to go out on patrol side by side with the Iraqis and show that they were brave and that they were effective in combat.
Yeah. And of course, in that first example that you give in your book, one of the Iraqi soldiers was killed in that explosion. You know, which absolutely, you know, strained relations, I would think, between them and their American advisors.
The snake eaters, advisors are like jockeys switching atop a thoroughbred. The development of this battalion called the snake eaters of Iraqi, very mostly professional Iraqi soldiers, by the way, who had served in both the Iran-Iraq war and then had fought the United States forces twice. They had been mentored by four teams of advisors by the time I arrived. But each advisor has to figure out his or her own way of building credibility. When Mike Troster's team of reservists arrived, the Iraqis were really disappointed because they considered themselves special forces. They were one of the first Iraqi units ever assembled in the new Iraqi army. And here they were supposed to be advised by reservists who'd never been to combat before. I mean, it didn't make any sense to them. The very first patrol, as you said, the Iraqis had one man killed in action and three wounded. On the second patrol, they had another man killed in action and another man wounded. And on the second patrol, the U.S. advisors and the Iraqi proteges came to blows and pointed their machine guns at one another. So it was very tenuous at the start. Mike Troster then had to figure out, I mean, he had several problems, but the first was, you know, how to build any form of credibility so the Iraqis would even listen to him.
Yeah. And, Owen, with that in mind, why were you willing to return to Iraq in that sort of capacity to be a combat replacement for advisors? You'd already done one tour. You had a sense of what things were like there. What made you want to go back?
Well, I did leave my job in 2003 to join the Marines for the invasion, but really saw no combat. And believe it or not, that was frustrating for a Marine, as it would be for any Marine infantryman. I went back in 2004 as an embedded reporter and saw much more combat, but I still felt that I needed to contribute. And the irony was that I'd been brought up believing that this advisor model was really the most effective tool we had in fighting counterinsurgencies. Mm. My father had written a book in the early 70s called The Village about a team of Marines who tried to do the same thing in Vietnam. I remember it was one of the lowest grades I'd ever gotten. It was in the fourth grade I did my first book report on The Village and received a B-, which was unacceptable in the West household, especially on book reports.
Absolutely.
And, you know, my dad said, look, there, no one is really ready for a story, a positive story about Vietnam. But I'd grown up believing that advisors were much more cost-effective, indeed much more effective than sending in hundreds of thousands of conventional troops and spending, as we have now, over $1 trillion on these two wars. And this is why we need to hone our advisor doctrine, because we've finally realized, I think, after 10 years of war, that only local troops can ferret out the insurgents among them. I mean, President Obama has adopted the template we used for an orderly withdrawal from Iraq by saying that we're basically going to take an advisory role, which I think is absolutely correct. The problem is that no one knows what it is advisors are supposed to do.
Right.
I mean, they're a mystery to the U.S. public, and indeed, the politicians themselves are very confused. As the president has said several times, advising means training. Unfortunately, he's incorrect. The advisor's first job is to fight.
Well, I think that's where the confusion is, Owen, because when people think of the term advisor, they think of a mentor, they think of a coach. They don't think of someone who is actually, you know, riding in a convoy looking, you know, to weed out the suicide bombers.
No, that's right. Yeah, and I think this is, again, something that the American public needs an education on. As we approach 2014 and our mission shifts in Afghanistan, people will be surprised when these small, isolated teams of advisors take very heavy casualties. I mean, casualties in advisor teams are much larger than they are in conventional units because they're much more exposed. And I think, you know, wide-scale education on the role is appropriate not only for our citizens, but also for the advisors who are tasked with this, who, by the way, are still a little bit confused when they go over.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned your dad, Bing West, and many of our listeners will know his name. In fact, he has been on this show. We want to talk a little bit about him as well and what he thought about you going back and what his advice was for you, and to talk about some of the guys that you met in your time there, both the Iraqis and the Americans. I'd like you to do some character studies on them because I think they're an interesting bunch of guys. We'd love to hear from our listeners as well. The number is 888-477-9499. We are talking about the advisory role in Iraq, as written by a former Marine. You're listening to Radio Times, and we'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Athena Health, offering physicians a dinner seminar on meaningful use and profitability, Thursday, May 17th at the Chelsea. Details at athenahealth.com/NJNPR.
The Wistar Institute supports WHYY. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute. Melanoma is the deadliest skin cancer, taking the life of one person every hour in America. You can protect yourself this summer by using sunscreen and limiting your time in the sun. Scientists at Wistar's Melanoma Research Center are committed to understanding the causes and developing effective treatment for melanoma and better ways to prevent it. The Wistar Institute. Today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures, online at wistar.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane.
I'm Terry Gross.
And I'm Dave Davies. Help WHYY celebrate 25 years of Radio Times and Fresh Air at a special live event.
Dave will ask the questions. Marty and I will have to answer them at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Philadelphia.
It all happens Monday, June 4th at 7, and you can reserve your tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Celebrate 25 years of public media's best, Radio Times and Fresh Air.
Chestnut Hill College takes a holistic approach designed to inspire a passion of learning and a rewarding educational experience. The Chestnut Hill College School of Graduate Studies. Chestnut Hill College supports WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about a newly released book called The Snake Eaters, An Unlikely Band of Brothers and the Battle for the Soul of Iraq. The author of that book is Owen West. He is a former Marine major, and he actually played a role as an advisor in Iraq as part of that and wrote about the experiences that he had and that some of the troops before him had in that role, as well as the Iraqis. It is a fascinating account of what the advisors were up against. And Owen, I want to talk a little bit more, as we said, about your dad, Bing West. Many people are familiar with his work. He served in Vietnam and in the Reagan administration. He's a highly respected writer in his own right. What advice did he have for you when you decided that you wanted to go back in that advisory role, especially since the manual had been sort of, you know, blown up after Vietnam? What did he say about that?
You know, he didn't have too much advice about that. I mean, as I said, the military service has been a part of our family. I knew I wanted to join the Marines from the time I was seven. So much of you know, our miniature culture is left unsaid. I think one of the things that he believed, and I also believe, is that to contribute, if you can contribute to the country in many ways, military service, especially the Marine Corps, is a great way to do it. And then to make a lasting contribution, you had to write it down. So this book took me 4 years of research and writing. It was a long 4 years. In the age of Twitter, I don't know how well we match up, with most of the population now in terms of what that writing had to look like.
Right.
But I have memorialized the contributions of these folks who mentored this Iraqi battalion.
Well, so much of the book is really about the soldiers who served just before you got there. I mean, we don't see you appear until the last part of the book, actually. And I was struck as I read it about how you were able to create such vivid accounts of the struggles of the troops before you, because really it made me feel like I was there, and I certainly felt like you were there, even though you were not. How were you able to do that?
Yeah, that actually started on my first night at this tiny little outpost we called the Ammunition Supply Point, which overlooked this city called Caladia, only 400 meters away, which was a nasty little bed of insurgents. I went through Lieutenant Colonel Mike Trosser's after-action reports. I mean, you have to remember that we kind of over-report these wars. So there was plenty of information about the year he had spent prior to my arrival trying to figure out, number one, how to gain credibility with the Iraqis, and then number two, a much bigger task, how to crack the insurgency in town where the local population basically shielded the guerrillas. So each little action had its own write-up. I probably spent a week staying up very late reading his account of what they'd done, and I came to the basic conclusion that contrary to modern counterinsurgency theorists, Mike had decided that he was going to go in and fight. He was going to go in and patrol. That's how he gained credibility and eventually began to crack the insurgency. The really interesting thing was that I arrived in October of 2006, just after the Marine Corps issued a report saying that Anbar Province was basically controlled, the everyday lives of the people were controlled by Al-Qaeda in Iraq. 4 months later, that insurgency fell apart and the battle was over. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was an astonishing turn. So I was there for the turn. Otherwise, I wouldn't have put myself in the book at all.
Yeah, if it hadn't been successful, you couldn't have owned up to it, right? Well, let me do this, because we have lots of questions for you, but we've also got callers waiting to talk to you as well. So let me go to the phones. We'll start off in Newark, Delaware, and we'll bring Tammy in on our conversation. Hi, Tammy.
Hi.
Your comment or question?
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a wife of a reservist, and I'm terrified of the idea of another deployment being similar to this one, and I'm wondering if, based on his experience, if you've had any suggestions and if anyone's listened to your suggestions about how to improve the productivity of the training of the reservists, because I know my husband's often very frustrated with the lack of productive training on his weekend once a month. And I'm wondering if anybody's listened to you and is trying to improve that to prepare them better.
Thanks, Tammy. Great question.
As a reservist or a part-time reservist myself, I can say you're absolutely right. Many of us are frustrated by the structure of the reserves and the training, and no one's listening to me. But, you know, I will say that the reserves, let me say two things. The reserves, in my judgment, are designed for a 1950s workforce. You drill 1 weekend a month, and then you have to take 2 weeks of, essentially, that many companies look at it as extra vacation a year. But I'm not sure that's adequate preparation for the modern battlefield. Then once you're activated, there's a period of time where you're supposed to snap back into the regular military with really productive training. For advisors, that has gotten a lot better. And by the way, I do believe reservists make excellent advisors because they've got a boot in each culture. I mean, on the one hand, they may wear a blue collar or a white collar, but they have to deal with many different personalities throughout the week. And on the other hand, they put on a combat boot and a camouflage uniform and during the weekend have to deal in a military environment. That flexible personality makes you an excellent advisor. The problem is, as I said, we need to write some advisor doctrine. I mean, famously, a few years ago, we did put out a counterinsurgency manual called 324, which I have some disagreement with because it advocates, essentially a nation-building strategy. That's helpful in terms of understanding insurgencies in general, but we need a nuts and bolts advisor manual. And the basic ethos of advisors should be to imbue in your foreign protégés the belief that they are dominant on the battlefield. This is one of the structural problems that we have in Afghanistan, because although in Iraq we always believed our local troops were going to defeat even the hardcore AQI fighters, in Afghanistan, many of the folks who advise the Afghan army soldiers just don't believe their guys are as tough as the Taliban. That's a long-term structural issue.
And let me just stop there. When you say AQI, you're talking about Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Is that what you're referring
Correct.
To?
Okay. Yeah, our little insurgency was a pretty wild cocktail. I mean, you had local boys who were paid $70 to $100 to dig a hole. That's it. Then you had other boys, totally disparate, by the way, who were paid to put a mine in that hole. Then you had smarter folks who would wire that mine and cover it up. And behind them, of course, were the bomb makers who were less local. And then the folks who were supplying the money, who often came from Syria or who were run by Zarqawi, who was the leader of the insurgency at the time. So there were a mix of kind of local gang members and then big cartels, if you'd use that analogy.
Was it amazing to you that for $70 that somebody would be willing to participate in burying one of these bombs that was designed to kill as many people as possible?
Not really. And just as I'm not surprised that some advisors are being murdered by their protégés in Afghanistan as we speak. Not as we speak, but, you know, recently. You have to remember that for many of these folks in fractured countries where we enter and try and rebuild, failed states who harbor terrorists, conventionally U.S. troops can be an antibody in that culture. This is why I believe the advisory model, where we put small groups of troops and build up local armies to root out their own insurgents, is just far superior than throwing all this money and troops at these things. So there is an underlying hatred of the U.S. soldier in many of these countries. And indeed, in Anbar province, which was Sunni dominated, there was a hatred of the Jundis, who were the Iraqi soldiers, who were mostly poor Shiites who had joined for the paycheck. So one of the things the Americans' advisors were shocked by was that the Jundis were hated as much by the locals as they were.
Did you have problems with insurgents mixing in with the Jundis at all?
You know, this is a problem in Afghanistan, again, that we really didn't see that often in Iraq. Most of the time when you have these green-on-blue engagements, as they're called, when you have a local supposedly allied troop shoot a friendly U.S. soldier, they're personal. I mean, in battle, you know, many of my guys, or several of my guys, got into fistfights among themselves and shoving matches with local Iraqis. So most of the times when someone actually pulls out a weapon and shoots someone else, it's a personal thing, or that was the case in Iraq. And there were very few of these incidents. Now, you know, upwards of 15% of the U.S. small arm casualties in Afghanistan have come from local supposedly friendly troops. This indicates some kind of structural flaw.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Center City next, and we'll bring John into our conversation. Welcome, John, to Radio Times.
Thank you.
And your comment or question for Owen?
My question for Owen is, are the locals that were trained ever willing to confront members of their own tribe and religious affiliations, such as Shia and Sunni, in support of government policy?
That is a great question. And from what I saw, no. I think John's asking, you know, if you have, because Iraq and Afghanistan are intensely tribal places, which we really have a tough time understanding, because most Americans put our backgrounds, especially in the military, behind us. I mean, we are there for the flag. We did have cases where my unit, which was stationed in Anbar province, did so well in putting down the insurgency there that they were eventually promoted and made Prime Minister Malaki's personal response unit. But when they went into Baghdad, which is mostly a Shia area of Baghdad, some of the soldiers did refuse to fight or begin to ferret out the local insurgents because either they didn't want to kind of go after their own, or in one case, they actually had some friends on the insurgency roster. This is a very complex issue, and it really goes back to loyalty. You know, to whom is the Afghan or Iraqi soldier really loyal? On balance, Iraq was fairly secular. So I think with a good minister of defense, you could deploy people properly. And I do think I'm pretty hopeful for the long-term situation in Iraq, especially as it affects U.S. Safety. In Afghanistan, I think the outcome is mixed.
Well, let me remind you that you are listening to Radio Times on WHYY, and we'd love to hear from our listeners. The number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about the role of military advisors, specifically in Iraq, but also what it's like for those who are in Afghanistan even now. Owen West is our guest. He's the author of The Snake Eaters, An Unlikely Band of Brothers and the Battle for the Soul of Iraq. Owen, give us some character sketches, if you would, some thumbnails about some of the guys who were involved as advisors, some of the Iraqis. I'm thinking about, first of all, someone like Huss, whose name is quite prominent in your book.
Yeah, I mean, part of the neat thing about advising is it is personality-based. The guys used to call it Survivor on steroids after the TV show because, you know, this is a very tricky job, military advising. You've got to have some political skills, I'd say equal to, you know, at least someone who runs kind of for one of these mini offices in colleges or as a local state rep. You've got to have survivalist skills because you don't have the access to the logistics that U.S. units do. You're really living as an Iraqi or an Afghan, which can be shocking to some advisors. You know, and then, of course, you have to have military and interpersonal skills. So that's a difficult confluence. And not everyone is cut out to be an advisor. There are many, many terrific infantrymen who we mistakenly assign to the advisor unit who just lack the patience to deal with all the personalities. Huss was a plumber. His job in the reserves was to teach big units how to build laundry facilities. And on day one, he's assigned as the patrol leader to go into a nasty little city where they're hit immediately by an explosive. One Zhundi is killed in action. Four are severely wounded and crying out, "Wounded, wounded, evacuate me." They had learned to speak, you know, English, especially when it came to medevac procedures. Huss looked around and realized as the Zhundis began to kind of pile in behind him, at 6 feet tall and 200 plus pounds in all his armor, I mean, he afforded them the best protection on the battlefield. And they began like a, you know, like a group of ducks to fall in behind him. So he realized immediately what his job was, and that was to lead them in combat.
What about Doc? He was one of the favorites.
You know, most medics are generally the favorite of the foreign protégés because their medical care is so poor that even, you know, a military-trained doctor or medic who patrols alongside the rest of his team in a platoon, you know, this to them, I mean, any access to 21st century healthcare is you know, really relished. Mm-hmm. So the medic is usually the favorite guy in the team, and Doc Blakely also had the personality to go along with it. I mean, he used to buy things with his own money for the people in town. He always carried Pop Rocks or candies to hand to the kids, but, you know, his method of counterinsurgency was really effective. While most guys use their rifles in their heads, Doc really used his medical kit and his heart. So as the kids would come up to him, he'd also give them hasty examinations and then occasionally pull one out of line and say, there's a real problem here. Treat him. And, of course, he made huge inroads in town because even though the folks hated the Jundis and their American advisors, when Doc Blakely was there, it was hands off because everyone wanted medical care. In January of 2006, a sniper tried to kill Doc Blakely, shot him through the shoulder. The other advisors were worried because this is called turtling when you try to shoot a man between the lower lip of his helmet and the upper rim of your armor plate, which protects your torso. It just means that a sniper out there knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Blakely could have been evacuated. He decided to self-treat the wound. Indeed, the rumor was that he'd made the Jundis faint that night when he stuck a bacitracin-laden Q-tip deep into the wound in front of them. Governor Mitch Daniels from Indiana came over and presented him with the Purple Heart, which he refused to talk about. He shoved into a footlocker and didn't allow the other guys to even ask about it. Unfortunately, 6 months later, while walking down the street, he was shot in the same area by a sniper that we called the Sadakia sniper and killed instantly.
Same area, right?
Same area.
In terms of where the actual bullet went, right?
Where the actual bullet went and the area of town. This was devastating, not only for the advisor team, but all the Jundis began to scream and cry in rage. I mean, they were much more emotional than Americans. Americans, when you lose a man, will cry, but they tend to brood and plot revenge. The Iraqis rode those emotions immediately until they were spent like a horse. And there were Iraqis, when Mike Trosser came down to recover Doc Blakely's body, rolling around on the ground crying because they'd lost Doc. And one of the telling signs of, you know, how valuable Doc was to the team was there were locals who were devastated by his death. So whoever did this was very calculated, and it's not unlike, you know, a car bombing or a suicide bombing in the middle of a market where they try to kill non-combatants. It's hard for us to understand, but they do have a theory, the enemy behind it.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit more about that, about whoever did it, about Major Muhammad, because he was certainly one of the interesting characters in your books and so many other things. We invite our listeners to call in 888-477-9499. We're talking about the book The Snake Eaters on Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Abington Health supports WHYY. Their Orthopedic and Spine Institute is performing a procedure called anterior hip replacement. Using a mini incision and specifically designed surgical table, surgeons at Abington and Lansdale Hospitals are able to replace the hip joint through the front rather than the side, sparing muscles. The hospital stay and the recovery time are shorter, enabling patients to return more quickly to regular activities, like driving. More at abingtonhealth.org/bone.
Hey everybody, Jad here. I wanted to let you know that Radiolab is coming soon to Philadelphia for a live show. We're calling it In the Dark, and it's all about darkness and light, seeing, believing. It's going to be a super fun night because we've got the comedian Dimitri Martin coming with us, the singer-songwriter Tao Nguyen, and the amazing dance troupe Palabolas. They'll all be there. We'll be there June 29th at the Academy of Music. You can get tickets at radiolab.org.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Charles Dutoit, in his final concerts as chief conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra, leads Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe. And with Maria João Pires, Chopin's second piano concerto.
Tickets online or by phone, 215-893-1999. This Thursday and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, a celebration of Charles Dutoit and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
You are listening to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with Owen West, who is the author of the newly released book, The Snake Eaters, An Unlikely Band of Brothers and the Battle for the Soul of Iraq. It's all about the American advisors working with the Iraqi troops and fighting right alongside them, rooting out insurgents and so forth in Iraq. Owen was a part of that group for a while. He also happens to be a Wall Street executive. He's a third-generation Marine. And Owen, when we left off, you were giving us some sketches of some of the guys that played a role either as an advisor or some of the Iraqi troops and so forth. I want to get to Major Muhammad in a moment, but there was a kid named Kamal that you talked about in the book that was arrested after Doc's murder. Tell us about him, and it sounds like he didn't stay in jail for very long, from what I recall.
No, Kamal was the suspected killer of Doc Blakely, who was discovered by one of the Iraqi captains named Captain Hadi, who had been rifling through a suspected insurgent's letters and discovered love letters that were written to the insurgent's daughter by Kamal, bragging about killing Blakely. Mm. A team of SEALs went in at midnight with one of the U.S. advisors, Major Walt Roberson, and plenty of Jundis to try to capture Kamal. Now, when you do one of these midnight raids, also called hits, it's very rare for the enemy to run. Indeed, you know, you do snap up innocents on these hits, but most of those folks stay absolutely static. They go in, we process them, and realize that we've captured the wrong folks or don't have enough evidence to keep them. Hmm. In this case, Kamal disappeared at midnight and was running along rooftops and jumped into a water tank, holding his breath while the SEALs searched for him. He was eventually captured when he came up for air, dragged down the stairs. The Jundis wanted to end the matter right there by killing him with a club. The Americans, and especially advisors who are ombudsmen of the battlefield, they're often put in very tricky moral situations like this where, you know, we really allow for very little cultural relativism, certainly not murder on the battlefield. The advisors intervened, prevent Kamal from being killed in retribution on the spot. He was arrested, and unfortunately, the Jundis said, well, you know, he's going to be released in under 10 years. And they were wrong. He was released in under a few months. This problem was endemic throughout Iraq. We called it catch and release, meaning that the justice system and the jail system was not built up enough to keep hardcore insurgents in jail. And this is a problem we still face in Afghanistan today. We rely on a faulty justice system for the battlefield. Indeed, we apply U.S. evidentiary requirements on a very chaotic shooting war, and this is difficult, especially when your enemies are being repatriated.
Well, it's got to be immensely frustrating for the advisors, in this case the Jundis as well, because I'm sure that there were some advisors who had a lot of good reason to want this kid dead. And, you know, having spared him, to see him back out on the street so quickly, it's got to be very frustrating to see that happen.
That's tough, and it happens every day in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Tell us about Major Muhammad. He was not necessarily fond of the Americans, but he definitely got some press in your book.
Major Muhammad was the toughest Iraqi officer in the Snake Eater Battalion. He never wore a helmet. He didn't wear body armor. He could shoot extremely accurately. He'd walk down the middle of the street. Everyone in town knew him. The bounty on his head was highest as a result. From the local insurgents, I think, would pay upward of $2,000 for the man who killed Muhammad, because he had, you know, he really acted like a benevolent dictator in town. There was an intense mix of love and hate for Muhammad. He didn't like advisors that much. I mean, he used to compare, you know, the advisory relationship to an arranged marriage. I mean, who were these plumbers and doctors and you know, electric guitarists who were supposed to tell him,
right,
who had fought for many years, what to do on the battlefield? And because of that, the Americans loved him most. You know, he wasn't a sycophant. He could shoot accurately, and most of all, he was good in combat. And that's what counted in the end.
Mm. Well, tell us about Alex, because Alex became very special to you and your family.
Alex was a translator. That's not his real name. And no one has it tougher on these modern insurgencies in both Iraq and Afghanistan than the interpreters who try to aid U.S. troops. Interpreters are considered traitors by their hometown friends, and even in our case, the Jundis, or the Iraqi troops whom Alex was fighting side by side with, didn't really trust him because they felt his loyalty was to the Americans, and that's right. Alex wanted to be an interpreter because he wanted freedom. I mean, he noticed that the Americans wore the same uniforms, but as he began to pick up this pidgin English, he worked a small-time job on a big U.S. base for a time. That's where he learned his English skills, and then bluffed his way into the interpreter ranks. He realized that even though Americans wore the same uniforms, they were free, and that's what he wanted. Mm. He paid a high price for his duty. His brother was executed because of him. Some local militiamen burst into Alex's hometown house in Baghdad one night and saw that he had a U.S. Marine Corps flag hanging in his room. They plucked his brother's eyes out, tortured him to death, and as late as 2 years later, were still calling Alex's 9-year-old brother, asking him to come to another meeting point to get the eyes. Mm. So it was ruthless for a time. Alex eventually, though, did make it to the United States on a special immigrant visa. I'm very proud of him. He now is at the University of Nebraska, and 2 weeks ago graduated U.S. Army Airborne School, jumping out of planes, and he's wow. going to be a U.S. officer one day. So, I mean, it's a real testament to his grit and also his service to this country yeah. as well as his own.
Well, and you said he was a big factor in you even writing this book.
He was. You know, I came back from Iraq, and I was convinced that the advisor model, which we call in military jargon a combat multiplier, meaning instead of putting 1,000 troops on the ground at a cost of, you know, $100 billion a year in total for all the troops we have, why not put small teams of 12 who can advise as many as 1,000 local troops at a sliver of the cost mm-hmm. and as a more effective tactic? So I wanted to participate in this debate. This was at the height of the surge, as you remember, which was dominated by U.S. troops in Iraq. So I wrote a few op-eds, but you know, eventually my family and job responsibilities caught up to me, and I just didn't see how I could really take the time to research properly and write a book. Alex arrived in the United States in 2008. He lived with my family in our New York City apartment, and at the time, this was during the presidential debates between John McCain and Barack Obama, and, you know, Iraqi men love politics, and every night he would berate me about how wrong they were about these wars. And he'd just say, you know, Major, you need to write about the snake eaters to help them understand. So he was indeed the final push.
Mm. I wonder what all this means for the advisors in Afghanistan. And I know you touched on this a little bit earlier in our conversation, but based on what you know from your experience and that of many others like you, is it realistic that we can leave a stable Afghanistan on the timetable that we're looking at? And what are your concerns for the people who are in that same role now over there?
Yeah, I think it is realistic to leave a stable Afghanistan, meaning if you look at the fact that we'll have dominant air cover for years to come and how far we've come with these drones, essentially surveillance, there is no way that the enemy can mass, for instance, and attack Kabul and take Kabul as they did 15 years ago. So, I mean, in that respect, I don't think that Afghanistan will be a threat to U.S. security. The astonishing thing is that how long it took us to realize that U.S. troops alone could not do the job. I mean, as many dollars and as many troops as we've thrown at these two countries, it's amazing to me that it basically in Afghanistan took about 6 years for us to get serious about the advising program and building mm-hmm. up local police and army to secure their own country. And all I'm saying is that this advising has to be a part of our quiver. I mean, we employed this successfully throughout the 20th century, starting in the Banana Wars, even in World War II in Korea, in Colombia, and El Salvador. Right now, we have advisors in 12 countries doing very effective work. We don't hear much about them because, as I said, that they're very light footprint and they're very cost effective. But in the bigger wars where we enter failed states, which we may again, to secure, you know, in our own interests, we need to turn to advisors much more quickly.
Well, I'm thinking, Owen, that maybe you're the one to rewrite the manual on that. I'm just saying.
You know, my wife agreed to allow me to write this book because all the proceeds are going to the children of fallen Marines and soldiers and the Iraqi snake eaters. She's a former teacher. I don't think I'm going to get permission anytime soon to write another book. There were a lot of late nights. I had a regular job, so most of the writing took place on the train, and most of the interviewing took place very late at night, which works when you're talking to an Iraqi on a sat phone, but not so well when you're trying to interview a guy in Indiana for the 15th time.
Wow. Talk about the Marine Scholarship Foundation. You just sort of briefly mentioned that, but that is near and dear to your heart.
It is. I mean, the neat thing about the era we're in is that there seems to be a nationwide movement afoot to help our veterans that's totally apolitical. This is, of course, not what happened after Vietnam and was not the way my father was treated when he came back, for instance, and I think it's terrific. The president, both presidents, actually, Bush and Obama, have basically left it up to individual citizens to figure out how they should contribute to this movement. You know, I choose to donate some money and spend some time on the intersection between education and military service. And the Marine Corps Scholarship Program honors Marines by educating their children. I mean, I'll tell you as a father on the battlefield that you're not so concerned if you get clipped, you know, for your own life. What you're worried about is that you're leaving kids behind. Yeah. So I think our first priority should be taking care of the children of the fallen. And most of these kids are going to be first-time collegiates, which is really nice.
It's exciting. I have to ask you, Owen, because we've talked about you've two prior novels. Now you've written The Snake Eaters. You work on Wall Street. You're a third-generation Marine. You've done two tours of Iraq. And then I heard something about you running 100-mile marathons and climbing Mount Everest. What's up with that? And where do you find the time to do all that?
Yeah, this is from my former life without the kids. Right now, I part of the agreement I have with Suzanne is that I coach every sport that my two children do. So I'm tied up with them right now, but my days are over. Yeah, I did do a lot of endurance sports. I mean, one of the nice things about the Marine Corps is it teaches you how to suffer.
And, which comes in handy, you know, sometimes.
That's right. We may not be as pretty as U.S. Navy SEALs, but we're used to long slogs in the mud. So I did do these 100-mile ultramarathons. I did attempt to climb Mount Everest, and I hope to again when the kids are old enough to accept the fact that something may go wrong when I'm 65 and just write me off as a crazy person.
What about growing up, Owen, just very quickly, did you feel pressure given that your dad, you know, was who he was and you're a third generation military person? Was there pressure to achieve in your house?
Not really. And there certainly wasn't pressure to join the Marine Corps, which is the misconception most people have of many of us whose fathers served. You know what's really interesting? How many children of general officers and you know, even U.S. senators there are in the Marine Corps. I mean, I've run, every commandant so far has had an officer that I've run into. It's a small Marine Corps, but, you know, the war is basically shouldered by 1% of the population. That's been, you know, quite famously reported. What people don't understand is that there's a lot of lineage within today's military as well. But the bottom line is you can't join the military unless you really want it. I mean, the last place you want to be is in the Marine Corps if your heart's not in it, and especially as a Marine on the battlefield.
Yeah.
Most Marines really want to get overseas, which is the interesting thing about today's all-volunteer force because, for instance, while most people may, in the military even, debate our prospects in Afghanistan, when each man's tour comes up, he's desperate to get over there because he wants to go serve.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of the offshoots of the all-volunteer military where folks have joined for this purpose. And contrary to what we heard in 2004 and 5 about breaking the military, I think we've now shown how strong this all-volunteer force is.
Mm. Well, I think those are fitting words to end our conversation. Owen West, thank you so much for writing this book and for sharing your experiences with us on Radio Times. We so appreciate your work.
Thanks very much for having me.
And once again, the book is called The Snake Eaters, An Unlikely Band of Brothers and the Battle for the Soul of Iraq. The author is Owen West, and he is a third-generation Marine. He was a Marine major. He's got two tours of Iraq under his belt. He has written two prior novels. In fact, one of them is an award winner called Sharkman 6, and you may remember the title of that book as well. When he's not fighting or writing, he is an executive on Wall Street. He works for Goldman Sachs and actually ended up leaving that job a couple of times to make these tours of Iraq and to not only study but to participate in the role of an advisor and to see firsthand what so many of the military reservists and the National Guardsmen are up against when they are thrust into that situation, weeding out terrorists and having to really experience what it's like to be in the heat of the battle. And he has chronicled that so well and has also suggested that it's about time to rewrite the manual on those things. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. You have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.